Good morning. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. A week ago this evening, dozens of people gathered at the Norman Public Library. The Norman Transcript's Joy Hampton reported that a state trooper who was working security had to bar the door to the Lowry Room once it was filled to capacity. They were all there to discuss the idea of banning the practice of hydraulic fracturing within the Norman city limits. The panel discussion was moderated by State Impact Oklahoma's Logan Layden, and he's here in the studio with me now. So, Logan, give me a little bit of background here. Why was this panel organized?
Well, this was the idea of a woman named Cynthia Rogers, who is an economics professor here at OU. And it really was a response to, and State Impact reported on this earlier this year, about a fracking operation in Norman that was actually hooking up to a hydrant in the city and using city drinking water for their drilling operation. And this, you know, disturbed a lot of people in the community and created quite a bit of outcry.
And I have the flyer announcing last Monday's forum here in front of me, and it was organized by the Scholar Strategy Network, the Sierra Club, the Red Earth Group, Clean Energy Future, OK, and Our Earth. What can you tell me about these groups?
Well, I know the Scholars Strategy Network is an organization that sponsors these types of events on many, many issues. But the other ones are certainly, I would say, more on the environmental activism side of things.
And who are the three panelists we're going to hear from?
Dr. Bob Poles, Director of the Oklahoma Water Survey, Associate Professor at the College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences here at OU. During his presentation, he talks a lot about the hydraulic fracturing process, which, you know, there's a lot of confusion about. It's a pretty complicated process, and, you know, a lot of the water contamination issues that people are concerned with, he addresses. Leah Messner, who's Assistant City Attorney for the City of Norman, talks a lot about what the Norman City Code is as it relates to the possibilities of regulating drilling, fracking in the Norman city limits. And then David Slotjay, he comes from upstate New York, and he's actually a Community Environmental Defense Council's organization he's with. He's an attorney. He's helped communities in upstate New York that have wanted to ban fracking do just that. And so he came to Oklahoma to try and convince folks here of the same thing.
Logan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
That's State Impact Oklahoma reporter Logan Layden. He moderated last Monday's forum in Norman about hydraulic fracturing that you're about to hear. The meeting lasted roughly 90 minutes, so we've edited out some portions in order to run in the hour allotted. You can hear the complete unabridged version on our website, kgou.org. Each panelist will deliver a 15-minute presentation followed by an audience Q&A. Here's the first speaker, Dr. Bob Poles from the Oklahoma Water Survey and OU's College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences.
Before I get started, I wanted to, first of all, make it clear that the opinions that I express here tonight are mine and not those of the University of Oklahoma. These opinions are based on my experience in working in this area for the last 5 years. So I wanted to initially get everybody on the same page in terms of terminology, because sometimes there can be confusion over this. Hydraulic fracturing is, strictly speaking, it's the process of injecting fluids under high pressure into a targeted formation to create fractures that then enable the release of gas and or oil. And a proppant is also injected along with those fluids to hold those fractures open, that then allows the oil and gas to flow into the wellbore up to the surface and be recovered. So one of the things that's done to protect fresh water are these different series of casings. Typically you have shallow conductor casing followed by surface casing. Surface casing is the main casing that protects the fresh water zone. And each state has its own regulations in terms of how deep that surface casing goes below the freshwater zone. And then there's intermediate casing. Often that is used to isolate other zones that may contribute to freshwater or groundwater contamination, things like shallow methane zones, for instance. And then finally, the production casing, which goes all the way down to the reservoir, the targeted formation that's going to be fractured. So hydraulic fracturing is just one part, one piece of the whole oil and gas production process. Horizontal wells are basically a fairly recent development. Hydraulic fracturing actually has been around for decades. In fact, the very first commercial hydraulic fracturing operation was done here in Duncan, Oklahoma in 1949. And the issue really with the horizontal wells is they've enabled oil and gas companies to access a much greater volume of the reservoir. So, for instance, in the Marcellus, a horizontal well can intercept 2,000 to 6,000 feet of a formation laterally, where that formation that's targeted may be a few hundred feet thick, whereas a vertical well in the past may be only intercepted 50, 100, 200 feet. The other thing about horizontal wells, they allow for multiple wells on a single well pad. And this is actually a good thing in terms of the footprint that exists on the land surface in terms of reducing the impact to the surface from things like traffic, lights, etc. So the horizontal wells really got developed in the 80s, but they really didn't get implemented until the 90s. First implemented in the Barnett Shale in Texas, and then in the Woodford Shale here in Oklahoma in the mid-2000s. In terms of risk pathways for water resources, it's my opinion and the opinion of many people, actually, and it's based by a lot of data, is that the main risk pathways to water resources are going to be from the management of those wastewaters on the surface, how they are handled, how they are managed, how they are transported, how they are eventually disposed of or treated. The other risk pathway is the production well itself. If the casing and the cement jobs are not done properly on the production well, they can leak. And if you have things in shallower zones, such as methane, they can move up the what's called the annulus, which is the space between the casing and the formation where the cement is supposed to fill. So there have been instances where that has happened. In terms of risk from hydraulic fracturing itself, the actual fracturing of the formation with the injection of those fluids and chemicals and sand, there's never been anything documented where that process, which usually takes less than a week, has actually impacted any groundwater resource. So really, the two factors that I see are risks are pit leaks, spills, wastewater disposal practices, and inadequate well construction. I want to talk a little bit about what produced water is. Basically, it's water that comes to the surface with oil and gas following completion. Completion meaning they've done the hydraulic fracturing, they've installed the infrastructure to collect the oil and or gas, and now what comes up is oil and or gas, but also water. Now, initially, when that pressure is released, sometimes they refer to that produced water initially as flowback water because you do get a bigger slug of water coming up over the first short period. And that water has lower total dissolved solids in it, has a higher percentage of the chemicals that were injected. And then over time, that shifts, and you get a greater percentage of formation water. Even in shale, which is highly impermeable, that's why we fracture it, there's water there. So what comes up is basically high salt content, oil and grease, composites of many hydrocarbons and other organic materials. Some natural elements can come up from the formation, things like iron, manganese, arsenic, and the chemical additives themselves that have been injected into the subsurface. Stray gas is another term that often you hear, and that it refers to the presence of methane and or other gases, ethane, propane, that moves from one location to another. and incidents of stray gas have been observed in some parts of the country, basically from a failure of the cement or the casing surrounding the wellbore. And this gas often is not coming from the frack zone. It's often coming from shallower zones in between the freshwater zone and the frack zone. And so if that well is not properly sealed, these gases can move upward along that wellbore, annulus, and access drinking water aquifers. So there's no health standards set for methane. The main concern is explosion hazard. So when you have methane in water, when it comes into contact with air, that gas will exsolve out of the liquid phase into the gas phase. And if you are in a confined space and you have very high concentrations of methane, there can be an explosion hazard. So different states have triggered concentrations in water for looking at that issue. In Pennsylvania, it's 7 milligrams per liter. If people's water has 7 milligrams per liter of methane, then the state will look additionally at that water because of the issue of the explosion hazard. In Wyoming, it's 5 milligrams per liter. In Colorado, it's 1 milligram per liter. And this is typical. Things like this vary from state to state. Next thing I wanted to talk about was the chemicals. More than 90% of what's injected is water and sand, but there is a variety of chemicals that are injected along with that water and sand, and they all have basic purposes. So there's biocides, corrosion inhibitors, iron control, cross-linkers and breakers to basically deliver the sand to the frack zone. Most of these things are there to prevent clogging, to allow delivery of the chemicals, to allow delivery of the sand to the frack zone. If you have corrosion in your pipe, or if you have precipitation, or if you have microbial growth, these things clog up the pipe, and then you can't get the oil and gas out. I want to talk briefly about water usage. This is from a recent DOE report 2 months ago. Basically looking at the Barnett and the Eagleford in Texas, the Fayetteville in Arkansas, the Haynesville in Louisiana, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, and the Niobrara in Wyoming and Colorado. And basically the take-home message here is that the average water use for these horizontal wells is about 5 million gallons. And then I wanted to talk briefly about, put it in context in terms of water permits. So the water usage for hydraulic fracturing here in the state, they typically have to get a permit from the Oklahoma Water Resources Board. And then finally, I want to talk about what's happening now. I think even with this small percentage, oil and gas companies are increasingly looking at other alternatives to freshwater sources, things like treated wastewater effluent, stormwater runoff, brackish groundwater or surface water, and also reuse of flowback or produced water, or basically recycling. So I want to conclude with some thoughts. What I have seen is improvements of surface management of wastewater and chemical handling and well construction practices over the last 5 years, together with better regulatory oversight. And these activities can significantly reduce the risk to water resources. Recent state and industry initiatives are constantly improving state of the practice for environmental protection and transparency. We have a ways to go yet, however. Baseline water quality data is important for adequate assessment of impacts to water resources. One of the things that I ran up against in the national study was people would give me their data, but it was always data following oil and gas operations, and nobody had data before oil and gas operations. So this pre-drill water quality baseline data is important. And then the continued development of the recycling of wastewaters and the use of alternative water sources is important to minimize not only water usage, but also reduce wastewater generation and therefore the amount of wastewater that we have to dispose of here in Oklahoma. That would translate into reductions in deep well injection volumes. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Dr. Poles. Very interesting. I knew we'd been doing it for decades, but not since 1949. Leah Master, go ahead.
Good evening. Thank you all so much for having me tonight. I wanted to say initially I'm so glad the meeting's being recorded and going to be re-aired on Monday. Unfortunately, three of our council members had to offer to leave tonight in order to respect Open Meeting Act provisions that require a specific notice if quorum of council is going to be present discussing city issues. So they will be catching it on Monday, it sounds like, and I'm glad that that's happening. I'm here tonight to talk to you about City of Norman oil well regulations, what we currently have on the books here in Norman. Initially, as some background information, our first ordinance regulating oil and gas drilling was adopted here in Norman in 1983. We currently have 163 permitted wells in the city limits of Norman. 125 of those are active, 18 are inactive, 16 are injection wells, 3 are supply wells, and 1 is a commercial disposal well. In addition, we have 2 new wells that are still in the process of being completed. Turning to our Chapter 13 regulations.
That's Norman Assistant City Attorney Leah Messner during a recent hydraulic fracturing forum at the Norman Public Library. She used the rest of her time to explain the rules regarding hydraulic fracturing in the Norman City Code, so we're going to skip ahead to Attorney David Slotjay's presentation. You can hear Ms. Messner's remarks in their entirety on our website, kgou.org.
Also, bulk water usage under a bulk water permit is prohibited during our Stage 3 conservation plan, which is severe, unless permission is granted by the city manager because of a substantial and unnecessary hardship. Bulk water sales account for 0.5% of total water used in Norman over the last 3 years, and the operators typically purchase one of these bulk water permits when drilling a new well. Thank you all very much.
Leah Messner, everyone. Mr. Slotjay, you're up. Your 15 minutes begin now.
Okay. My name is David Slotjay. I'm going to speak today about using local land use authority to protect health, safety, and community assets from the risks of injection wells and high-volume slick water hydrofracking. And I'm going to speak very quickly. And I apologize, because I think we want to get right to the comments, and B, I'm going to deviate a little bit from what I had planned to talk about to address some things that have come up. I want to thank the Scholar Strategy Network and everyone, all the sponsors of this forum, for inviting me to participate. Just some quick housekeeping. What I am saying is for educational purposes only. No attorney-client relationship is created. I am the General Counsel of Community Environmental Defense Council. We are a not-for-profit public interest law firm dedicated to helping communities obtain the protective benefit of land use and environmental laws. I'm admitted to practice in Texas and Massachusetts and in New York. I want to make it crystal clear that I am not admitted in Oklahoma. And one of the reasons I want to make that crystal clear is there are a lot of people, including a fair number of people in this room, who do not want you to hear what I'm about to tell you today. And they are going to do whatever they can to make sure that you don't hear it. And if you do hear it, they're going to try to discredit what I say later. One of the things they would try to do is say that I'm guilty of unauthorized practice of law in Oklahoma. So I want to be crystal clear. I am not admitted in Oklahoma, and I am not somehow pretending that I am. All right. Very briefly, what I'm going to talk about is what municipalities in New York have been able to do recently to protect their communities from the impacts of unconventional drilling. I'm going to talk about what powers Oklahoma charter cities have should they wish to consider enacting protective measures regarding drilling-related activities, including injection wells. And I'm going to tell you very briefly some common arguments that are made against enacting such protective measures. I realize we're in Oklahoma. I began my career in Dallas. I understand most people don't care what happened in New York. For most purposes, I don't care about what happened in New York. But some things that did happen in New York along the way I think some of you will find very interesting. Before I begin, I want to ask, is Mr. Terry Stowers here by any chance? Good. Mr. Terry Stowers.
Stowers.
I'm sorry, sir. Now, Mr. Terry Stowers, according to this, is a Norman Mineral Owner attorney and the executive director of the Coalition of Oklahoma Surface and Mineral Owners. They are the group that distributed this list. And I'm going to come back to this during my presentation. But I want to read one thing before I start that Mr. Stowers is quoted as saying in here, if he'll have an opportunity to tell me he didn't say it once I said this. According to this, Mr. Stowers says, the Oklahoma Corporation Commission has exclusive jurisdiction to regulate oil and gas operations, and I'm quoting, any attempt to ban the fracking of a well by a municipality would violate the exclusivity to regulate granted by the legislature. I'm going to repeat that. The Oklahoma Corporation Commission has exclusive jurisdiction, and any attempt to ban the fracking of a well by a municipality would violate the exclusivity to regulate granted by the legislature by the commission. I'd like you to remember that. I'm going to come back to it. And I am willing to stipulate that the accuracy of virtually everything else in this piece of paper is of the same degree, and it's just as accurate as what Mr. Stowers told you, and we're going to come back to that in a minute. There's a state statute in New York State that pro-fracking people says gives exclusive jurisdiction, I apologize to those of you I have my back to, over the siting of oil and gas wells and injection wells in the state. In 2010, my wife and I began explaining to people that notwithstanding that statute, New York State municipalities could use their home rule power, just like you have here in Oklahoma, police power. Police power is the authority of every municipality to enact laws to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people within the municipality and to protect the property within the municipality. So that's what police power is. You have it in Oklahoma in the Oklahoma Constitution. But I'll get back to that in a minute. So we explained to people that they could use their home rule police power to pass local land use laws to prohibit within their municipal borders, not outside, waste injection wells and other fracking-related activities. As you might expect, there was strong pushback from the industry. Much more than this, although there was a lot of this, the industry told people that I had failed the bar 4 times. I've only failed it 3 times. No. I've never failed the bar anywhere in any jurisdiction I've taken it. But they said in writing that I failed it 4 times. And other things to discredit us. Anyway, notwithstanding the threats, they went around, just like the bottom of this paper, although this is just a statement, not a threat yet, they went around and they told all these municipalities that were thinking about enacting protective laws that if they enacted those laws, they would sue the municipalities. And my grandmother always taught me not to point, but they would go in, I'm talking about industry representatives and royalty owner representatives, and they pointed at the various city council members and the town board members and said, I'm going to sue you personally, and you personally, and you personally, if you pass one of these laws. Well, by the beginning of 2014, almost 200 upstate New York municipalities, including every large city in upstate New York, had enacted a protective law, either a moratorium or an outright ban. Almost every city, we worked with virtually all of those 200 municipalities, and virtually every case, people came in and threatened to sue the municipality, almost every single time. In fact, they only sued 4 of them, and all 4 of them won at the lowest court level. In New York State, the lowest court level is the Supreme Court. So the 4 that got sued, and by the way, none of those had to pay their own legal fees, either because they were pro bono lawyers like us, or insurance, or citizens came up. So one of the things they'll say is, even if you win the suit, you can't afford your lawyer's fees. There are pro bono lawyers out there that you can afford, because pro bono means you don't pay for them. All right. The question went to the highest court in New York, which is a court called the Court of Appeals. And just about a month ago, they came down and confirmed unequivocally that municipalities could exercise their home rule authority and enact land use-based prohibitions on drilling and related activities. So once again, what Mr. Stowers is telling you is that Oklahoma municipalities do not have the legal authority to pass a protective law. He's telling you that the exclusive jurisdiction is with the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, and, quote, any attempt to ban the fracking of a well by a municipality would violate the exclusivity to regulate granted by the legislature to the commission. Now, I'm sure Mr. Stowers is an outstanding attorney. But let's see what the law in Oklahoma appears to be as opposed to his opinion. So it is true that there is a state statute here, just as there was in New York, that says that the Corporation Commission has exclusive jurisdiction with respect to various oil and gas activities, including siting wells and so forth. But guess what the people like Mr. Stowers don't want you to know about? They don't want you to know about the Oklahoma Constitution, and they don't want you to know about some other things. We have seen, and he has confirmed, that Mr. Stowers is telling everybody you can't pass these laws. There are a few lawyers in Oklahoma who disagree with him. First of all, as I'm going to show you, there's a state statute that specifically contemplates that charter cities, at least, have the ability to both regulate and prohibit the industry. There's a state statute. Secondly, there are many Supreme Court of Oklahoma cases, which I'm going to show you. I'm going to give you cites, and I'm going to show you the quote, that say that Mr. Stowers, no matter how great a lawyer he is wrong on this one. Okay? And lastly, so you've got the Supreme Court of Oklahoma, you've got the Oklahoma Constitution, you've got an Oklahoma statute, and lastly, we've got the Oklahoma Attorney General, who as recently as 2006 said Mr. Stowers is mistaken. So let's look at those. The Oklahoma Supreme Court has held, and by the way, I'm not an Oklahoma lawyer. I'm not practicing law in Oklahoma. I want to make that clear. I'm just reading the law, what it says. You don't have to be an Oklahoma lawyer, actually, to look up the cases and see what the Constitution says and what the Oklahoma Supreme Court says and what the Oklahoma statute says and what the Oklahoma Attorney General says. You don't have to be a lawyer to do that, an Oklahoma lawyer. So the Oklahoma Supreme Court has held that this exclusive jurisdiction that Mr. Stowers is warning us about does not take away the general police power of charter cities to provide for the safety and health of their inhabitants, and that cities, and I quote, do have the power under their zoning authority to regulate and restrict the real estate within the city limits for the development and production of oil and gas. There's a state statute. It's actually the oil and gas law in Oklahoma. And that specifically contemplates that cities might regulate or prohibit this industry. The preamble, nothing in this act is intended to limit or restrict the right of cities to prevent oil or gas drilling therein. According to the Oklahoma Constitution and the Oklahoma Attorney General, probably a pretty good lawyer, I would imagine, a charter city may, and I'm quoting, deny an application for the drilling and operation of an oil and gas well located within corporate city limits, even if the Corporation Commission has authorized the drilling and operation of the oil and gas well. Now, this is why I brought up New York, even though I know nobody really cares about New York. This is exactly what the industry's representatives did in New York. They came in and they pointed at a statute. They told people that it meant something that, in this case, in the case of Oklahoma, it doesn't mean, it clearly doesn't mean, says who, never mind me, says the Oklahoma Constitution, says the Oklahoma Oil and Gas Statute, says the Oklahoma Attorney General, and most importantly, says the Oklahoma Supreme Court. So you can rely on Mr. Stowers, or you can look at what the Oklahoma Supreme Court says, and the Oklahoma Attorney General, and the Oklahoma Constitution, and the Oklahoma Statute. But maybe he knows more than they do. Now, Norman is a charter city. Norman's charter gives the city power to promote the public health, safety, and welfare. That's the police power I talked to you about. Among other things, regulating the use of property, including exercising powers of planning and zoning. When a municipality exercises or attempts to exercise its police power, the standards are actually very favorable to the municipality. The standard is basically you have to be reasonable, and you can't be arbitrary and capricious. Arbitrary and capricious is basically the lowest standard the law recognizes. I am not a lawyer in Oklahoma, But I am a lawyer other places, and it's the standard everywhere else, and it is the lowest standard the law recognizes. If you can't satisfy arbitrary and capricious, it's like falling off a truck, as long as there's some connection with what you're trying to do. You don't have to be right, because some things, there's not certainty on. But as long as there's a reasonable relationship with what you're trying to do, you will not be under the law. You will not be overturned. So let's just look at one thing. Forget fracking, because people can argue about fracking and what fracking means, and I'll get into this later. Let's just talk about injection wells. Let's say hypothetically that the city of Norman was interested in banning injection wells. So we would have to say, well, would it be unreasonable and capricious to ban injection wells, either because we were worried about the contamination or things that people care about around here, the earthquake risk? Well, let's see. This is on their site. It's the USGS. What we found is there is a link between disposal of wastewater and earthquakes. In many of these cases, it's been fixed by shutting down the well or reducing the volume. Sentence one, there is a link. So there are really straightforward fixes. In other words, yeah, it can cause earthquakes, but we can fix it because we can tell people not to put anything more down there. Also from their site, although the disposal process does have the potential to trigger earthquakes, not every disposal well triggers an earthquake. All right. So would the city, if it was interested in banning or restricting or even a moratorium, a temporary ban, injection wells, would they win a fight if somebody tried to say it was arbitrary and capricious? Without question. Very quickly, typical arguments against enacting protective laws. The first thing people are going to tell you is if you do, and by the way, in New York, we're not allowed to regulate. We can only prohibit. The law is clear here, the Constitution, the state statute, the Oklahoma Supreme Court, and the Oklahoma Attorney General, as opposed to Mr. Stowers, all agree that you can both prohibit and regulate. And by regulate, I'm talking about things like setbacks. So you could say, you know, we're not going to prohibit this, but we want, say, a 2,000-foot setback or a 3,000-foot setback. The law is crystal clear in Oklahoma that you can do this. Crystal clear. I'm not admitted in Oklahoma. Now, the other thing they're going to tell you is that if you do something like this, you're taking their property rights. The people who say that, although I understand why they say that, those people are not familiar with the law. Here's what the law is in Oklahoma. It happens to be the law everywhere in the country, but I've just got Oklahoma cases for you. Property rights are always, 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 siempre, siempre, subject to limitation to prevent injury to rights of community and neighbors. I'm quoting now the Oklahoma Supreme Court. The right of an individual to use his property as he sees fit is qualified. It is not an absolute right. It is at all times subject to the authority of the state under its police power to promote the public health, safety, and welfare. I'm quoting the Oklahoma Supreme Court again with this slide. It's a well-settled principle that all property is held on the implied condition that it shall not be injurious to the equal rights of others to use and benefit their property. Think about that for a minute. The fact that you own property doesn't mean you can do whatever you want. Your right to do it, my right to punch this woman stops at her nose. I've got the right, but I can't punch her in the nose. You've got the right to do whatever you want with your property, but not if it hurts my property. That's not a taking. That's just how the law works in the United States of America. All right. The other thing they're going to talk to you about is legal fees. They're going to tell you that, okay, you can't afford this kind of lawsuit. We've got big lawyers, we got fancy lawyers, we got expensive lawyers. And if you pass one of these laws, we're going to sue you. And even if you win, because this is what they said to all of these towns in New York, even if you win, you will be bankrupt by the legal fees. Guess what? There are lawyers who will defend you for free. All right, the next thing they're going to tell you last thing is takings. I hope someone asked me a question about takings. My time is up. But I want to conclude with my friend Mr. Stowers again. This is basically a threat that if anybody decides to pass one of these laws, they are going to get sued for zillions of dollars in takings liability, which if I get the question, I'll answer when I get up there. It would be, quoting, it would be unwise for the city of Norman to expose itself to hundreds of millions of dollars in damages in a reverse condemnation, that's a regulatory taking, by tens of thousands of Oklahoma mineral owners. So he says, if the city's concerned, it should voice that concern to the Oklahoma Corporation Commission because only they have exclusive jurisdiction. Again, the Attorney General says he's wrong, the Oklahoma Supreme Court says he's wrong, the Oklahoma Constitution says he's wrong, and the state oil and gas statute itself says he's wrong. Thank you. Yeah.
I know it deviates from the plan a little bit, but since Mr. Stowers was called out personally from the audience here, I do want to give him a chance to at least give a short response here. We do have to get to audience questions, but I do want to give you a chance.
Well, I won't go through all of the reasons why I disagree with our speaker from New York. I do disagree. I believe, and if we want, we can brief this one if you'd like, but certainly home rule is not unlimited. It is bound by and has to be consistent with and subject to the Constitution and the laws of this state. So, yes, the city can regulate consistent with and in addition to the Corporation Commission, but they can't. It can't be counter to that. The Supreme Court has clearly said that where there is a conflict with the general laws, then the home rule has got to be. Let me just read it. Where the legislature has made or may by general law make a specific police regulation, that fact of itself will not prevent the lawmaking power of a city from making further regulations on the same subject. And here's the important part, not inconsistent with the general laws. A municipality may move in the same direction as the legislature, but not contrary to nor in the opposite direction. So there is limits.
Those were the very arguments that the Supreme Court of Oklahoma had before it. In applying those concepts, even with those concepts, that's when they said on multiple occasions, this is not one some one-off, that in the context, we're not talking about in a vacuum, in the context of either regulating or preventing this industry, they said it was okay. The Oklahoma Supreme Court said it was okay.
Folks, so the purpose of this tonight, more than anything, was to get audience members' questions answered, and we do want to get to that before we run out of time here in about 20 minutes. And so let's go ahead and get started with that. We have a question here. It says, I'm a homeowner in Norman and a mineral owner. What would a home rule do to my ownership rights?
I don't understand the question. So assuming, for example, that the city of Norman exercised home rule authority to, let's say, impose setbacks. Let's say it's sort of a broad question, so I'm just going to guess what the writer intended. If the exercise of home rule took the form of, say, imposing setbacks of, let's say, 3,000 feet, I'm picking these numbers, and maybe with certain sensitive receptors, such as schools and things, might have said 5,000 feet, whatever it is, my reading of the law, I'm not an Oklahoma lawyer, is that it wouldn't, I'm not really sure of the question, but that would be allowed. If that's a question to say, would that be a taking? No way that would be a taking. Let's say that the city of Norman exercised its home rule authority by doing a moratorium. I don't want to use the B word, ban, on injection wells in the city. And obviously, you can't do that retroactively, so it doesn't change anything that's already here. We're talking about prospectively or new injection wells. That wouldn't affect anything either. There is no way that would be a taking. So if the question is, would exercise of home rule constitute a taking, I would need a more specific example, but under the two that I just gave you, that is not a taking. And by the way, the question of a taking, even though there's a concept of a taking in the Oklahoma Constitution, as there is in everybody's constitution, except I don't know about Louisiana, but in everyone else's, I just don't know Louisiana, it's really a federal question. So even though I am not an Oklahoma lawyer, I am very confident The question of takings, by the way, is phenomenally, phenomenally complicated. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it is among the most complicated issues it deals with. I have read every single takings case that has ever come before the United States Supreme Court, and I understand them. So if we get to it, and I hope we will in a minute with the right question, I will explain to you what a taking is and what it isn't, and why the assertion in that letter that you all got about the takings is no more accurate than the assertion that you that only the Corporation Commission has jurisdiction to do this regulation. And again, in New York, we don't have the option of regulating. All we could do was prohibit, because our analog to the Corporation Commission, Department of Environmental Conservation, only they can regulate. But you can regulate. So you can do things if you want to do something less than a ban. You can do things like setbacks and the like. Who says? It's in the Constitution. It's in the statute. The Supreme Court has said it. Your Supreme Court has said it multiple times, and your Attorney General has said it as recently as 2006.
And Leah Messner, this person says they have 12 wells in their area now, and wants to know if there's a limit on the number of fracking wells per square mile in Norman.
There is not a limitation like that in the city code. I think that's regulated by the Corporation Commission.
I see. And also, how many wells have been plugged in the city since 1950? Unproducible wells have been plugged.
There are currently 18 inactive wells in the city of Norman that we have in city records.
And Dr. Pauls, I think this one would go toward you. Does the water used in fracking in any way diminish water that's available for domestic and agricultural wells? And where does the water end up? So does that take away from what's available for other purposes?
No, I think what I showed you was a comparison of the water use for different sectors, and by far things like public drinking water and agricultural irrigation take the most water. Oil and gas operations take a very small percentage, I think 0.5% here in the city. Statewide, it's a little higher than that, but not much. The problem can arise here in the south and southwest in periods of drought. So industry has, a couple years ago, when we were in the middle of an exceptional drought, there were some situations where it was difficult for industry to obtain the water they needed during that period. And I think that's one of the reasons they've looked more closely at water reuse, water recycling, and alternative sources of water, because actually they don't need to use fresh water to frack a well. They have developed recipes and chemicals now that actually can avoid the use of fresh water.
And now, Mr. Slajic, you might be able to answer this one. If the chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing are safe, why is it that companies keep them confidential? Because this is something that actually in our reporting has come up a little bit. And you wonder, all these companies seem like they're successfully fracking with their various, you know, ideas to do so. So why keep it secret? What does that do?
I am going to answer that question, but I first want to... The doctor's slides showed that, as a percentage, the oil and gas sector, the fracking, used 1%. I guess it was 0.5% in the city. Your slide said 1%.
1% for surface water, 3% for groundwater.
Okay, so 4%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but the difference between that and, say, agriculture or drinking water is that when agriculture uses the water, when you use it for drinking water, when you're done, you pee it out. And when the agricultural people are done, it goes back. And it goes right back into the hydrologic cycle, and it goes back into the sky, and it falls down again eventually. When this industry uses it for fracking, it is removed permanently. The water is literally destroyed. It's taken out of the hydrologic cycle. Again, 5 to 8 million gallons. And anybody who says it's not, then we got a real problem with those underground injection wells. Because if they're saying, no, it's not removed permanently, where is it? Now, I want to talk about, I'm answering, this is my answer to the question. I want to talk about Dick Cheney for a moment. Dick Cheney had two signature accomplishments by his own statement of what he did when he was in office. One thing he did was protect us from terrorists. You might agree, you might not agree whether it was effective, but that was one of the two things he focused on. The other thing he focused on, I want to tell you about something called the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act has one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is basically to protect underground sources of and potential sources of drinking water supplies. And the minute you do anything, you poke a hole, it doesn't matter if it's a septic system, it doesn't matter what we're talking about, that's governed by the Safe Drinking Water Act. Now, Mr. Cheney's other major accomplishment, in addition to protecting us from terrorist threats, and I'm not being facetious about that, he did it. Might have gone more than some of us, but he did it. He did was one thing. Some call it the Halliburton loophole, but it was a Dick Cheney. He single-handedly brought about an exemption from the Safe Drinking Water Act for the fracking process. Now, sometimes when legislation is passed at the state level or the federal level, the legislators, frankly, don't know what the heck it was. The lobbyists come in or the people who really know in the legislature say, this is what we want. And when somebody sponsors a bill, they may or may not know what they're doing, frankly, at the state level, at the federal level. Dick Cheney knew exactly what he was doing. Dick Cheney used to be the chairman of Halliburton. So he knew exactly what he was doing. And he says, by his own admission, that the number two signature accomplishment that he had was exempting the fracking process from the Safe Drinking Water Act. Now, if there's no reason to worry about fracking in the water supply, why did the second most powerful person in the free world, why did he spend his time making sure that fracking was accepted, exempted from the Safe Drinking Water Act? Now, you may say that that doesn't prove anything, just like it doesn't prove anything that all of a sudden we've got a zillion earthquakes. Yeah, we had them before, but we got tons of them now with the injection wells. But I would ask you, he's a smart guy. You might like him, you might not. He's a really smart guy. Why did Dick Cheney think it was so important, since there's no problem here, in 2005 to carve out from the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act the fracking process?
Dr. Paul, since earthquakes are mentioned, can you tell us a little bit about some of the evidence either to support or refute this causal relationship between, I guess it's wastewater injection, right, and earthquakes?
Well, I'm not a seismologist. I would say that it's quite anomalous, the amount of earthquakes that we've had lately. I think the Oklahoma Geological Survey and the USGS are looking at this very closely to figure out exactly what the cause and effects are and how to manage that. And I know that they're both working with the Oklahoma Corporation Commission in that regard. But seismology is not my area.
All right. Well, I understand. Lee Messner, maybe you could address this a little bit. One of the biggest concerns we hear a lot from people who read our stories and listen to them is about how folks in Norman can be asked to conserve water while a fracking company may use millions of gallons to frack a well. Could you maybe address that a little bit?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, bulk water sales account for 0.5% of the total water used in Norman over the last 3 years. Bulk water sales would not just be for oil and gas wells, but for construction sites as well. So it's a pretty small percentage of total water used in Norman over the last 3 years. I also have a figure for the new Barron well that's being drilled. They estimate using about 200,000 gallons of water over the life of the well. Mr. Jake is here with Barron. I hate to call him out, but I think they're hoping to be here for 40, 50 years if the well's a good producer. So you think about 200,000 gallons over 40, 50 years is a pretty small amount of water.
Mr. Slajay, you wanted to address the issue, I believe, of takings a little while earlier. Why don't you go ahead and do that now, some of the complexities of that.
I explained that. So to put this in context, Mr. Stowers, what he ends that little missive with is a statement, you might or might not take it as a threat, that if anybody has the temerity to enact one of these laws, there's going to be millions and millions and millions in dollars of takings liability. He called it reverse condemnation, but it's regulatory takings. Let me tell you very briefly what that is. Everybody knows the Constitution says, both the state and the federal Constitution, I am not an Oklahoma lawyer, but the Oklahoma Constitution as well as the federal Constitution says that if there's any taking of private property for a public purpose, you can't, for a public purpose, just compensation has to be paid. Everybody, most people know what eminent domain is. That's where the sovereign, the government, takes some of your property, either permanently or temporarily, maybe for a road widening or whatever. But there's a physical dispossession of the owner by the sovereign, by the government. And when that happens, when they move you off your property, temporarily or permanently, whether it's 1 inch or a half a mile, that's a taking. And no lawyer will ever tell you it's not a taking. What the lawyers fight about is the just compensation, and they fight like cats and dogs about what the amount is. A regulatory take, and there's nothing complicated about that. That is not what the Supreme Court was talking about. What Mr. Stowers is talking about is a regulatory taking. And very, very briefly, a regulatory taking is where a law is passed. There's no use that affects your property. The sovereign, the state, the government has not taken your property away, but they've passed a law. And whenever they do that, let's say that you wanted to, you had this piece of property and you were hoping someday in the future to put a 16-story office tower on, and the city puts a limit on the property and says, in this district, you can only have a 4-story property. Everybody squeals regulatory taking. Okay? What the law is, and this is not, I'm not going to say this is crystal clear. There's nothing crystal clear in this area. But what the law in this area is if there's anything you can do with the property after this act, this law that is supposedly a regulatory taking, it ain't a regulatory taking. So, for example, let's just go back to our injection well situation. Somebody's got some property. They want, they're not using it yet, in my hypothetical, for an injection well. The city puts, forget a ban, a moratorium on injection wells. There is no way under existing law that that's a taking because there are other things you can do with it. I want to tell you a story. One of the cases that just got to the Court of Appeals is a town of Dryden. It's sort of a suburb of Ithaca, although Ithaca is a suburb itself. What happened in Dryden was a Colorado-based oil and gas company came in, and they spent $4.7 million buying up leases. We don't have split estates, so when you want to drill there, you lease the property. So you probably heard, some of you heard of this company. It's Anschutz Oil and Gas Exploration. It's Philip Anschutz. So they came into Dryden. They spent $4.7 million on leases. Then the town passed its law. All the while that the town was talking about passing its law, they were in there saying, this will be a taking. We're going to sue your pants off. You can't afford it. $5 million, we can prove we spent $4.7 million, et cetera. I told the town, that ain't no taking. They insisted it was. The town listened to us, enacted the law. All right, they sued. Now, of everything that's happened in New York State, the single most sophisticated player was the Anschutz Oil and Gas Company. Nobody can question how sophisticated they are in these matters. So they sued. They lost. They lost at the trial court level. Once they lost, their lawyer, who is, if you go to his web page, is a super lawyer. That's sort of a marketing thing, but it's actually a thing. He's a super lawyer. So keep that in mind. And you'd expect somebody as sophisticated as Anschutz to have a super lawyer. So they lost, and the super lawyer went all across New York State, because remember, the issue wasn't just that town. The issue was all of these towns and cities that were passing these. And he went in Albany, our capital, and all across the state on radio stations and said, we're going to appeal this, and we're going to file, my word, but the mother of all takings cases. Eventually, he did this for about 2 weeks. Anybody who would listen to him, if they put a mic in front of him, he said it. Eventually, he said, you know, we're not sure we're going to appeal. But whether or not we appeal, we are going to file a takings claim. And it will be a very, very large takings claim. He didn't appeal. They sold their leases that they paid $4.7 million for $10 to somebody and walked away, and they appealed, and they lost. When they lost on the appeal, it was the same lawyer. He said, we're going to file a mega takings claim. Well, they didn't. They went to our highest court. They lost there. They never filed a takings claim. Now, I can tell you, I spent my entire career representing people like the Anschutz people, folks like that. And I can tell you that whether you're a super lawyer or not, you do not leave $4.7 million of your client's money on the table if there is anything you can do about it. And anybody who thinks $4.7 million is not a lot to Anschutz Exploration, the way you get to be Anschutz Exploration is to worry about $4.7 million. If there was the slightest chance that anybody could prevail on that takings claim, they would have filed that suit. And they did not. And they said exactly what that letter said, and we said, it ain't no taking. Now, the reason I talked about how rich he is, there are times when people have a legitimate legal claim, any kind of legal claim, where the doctor and I get into a fight, and I think that I have the right to sue him, and I think I'm going to win. I might not sue him, even if I'm certain that I'm going to win, because I might not have the money to pay the lawyer. So you could say, well, maybe the reason that Anschutz Exploration Company left $4.7 million on the table is because they couldn't afford to pay the lawyer. That is not why. They left $4.7 million on the table, and their super lawyer left $4.7 million on the table because they didn't have, excuse my French, a snowball's chance of hell of getting that money back. We could do 2 hours on takings, but what you see in that sheet is inaccurate.
Well, unfortunately, we only have like 2 minutes left, so I do want to get in just a couple of last quick ones here. Leah Messner, you know, all this talk about potentially banning fracking, is this something that you see as possible here in Norman? Could Norman do this? Is it considering it?
No, I can't really answer whether Norman is considering it or not. Not sure the city council has current plans to take that up. As to whether or not we could do it or not, I think we've heard from two different lawyers in the room tonight that have opposite views on the issue, and my response would be that this is a really unsettled point in Oklahoma law, and I think that if we were to take it up and were to pass a ban on fracking or a moratorium, that we might get a legal challenge, and I can't tell you for certain how it would come out. Definitely do more research and represent the city and the city council as best I could if they decided to take that position, but I couldn't tell you how a court would come down on that.
See, and lastly, I do want to talk to Mr. Slotjay just real quick, a couple of questions that came from the audience about the differences. You know, Oklahoma and New York, different places. We may, obviously, I think we do, rely a lot more on the oil and gas industry for our economy here in the state. What do we do? You know, if we start banning fracking operations, wouldn't that hurt our economy more than it did in New York?
I want to be clear that I am not here to suggest that the city of Norman or any other municipality in Oklahoma ban or even do a moratorium on unconventional drilling activities, well disposal or otherwise. I am only here to tell you that when you hear from people like Mr. Stowers that you can't do this, that the Oklahoma Supreme Court says you can. And when you hear from Mr. Stowers that it'll be a taking, I would ask you to tell me why Philip Anschutz walked away from $4.7 million if this was a taking. I don't have an opinion on whether you should do it. If you did do it, are there other industries that would want to come down here? I'm sure there are, but that's not for me to say.
You've been listening to last Monday's forum on hydraulic fracturing held at the Norman Public Library. The views and opinions expressed this hour do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU or our licensee, the University of Oklahoma. We had to edit this program in order for it to fit in our broadcast window, but you can hear the conversation in its entirety on our website, kgou.org. Our thanks to KGOU Chief Engineer Patrick Roberts for recording this public forum as part of our mission of community service, and State Impact Oklahoma's Logan Layden for moderating. For KGOU and Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hardzinski. Stay tuned next for Here and Now with national news headlines from NPR and a local update from KGOU.